We're going to unwrap that a little bit today, and the format is going to be very informal. So this is really a conversation. So please feel free to jump in whenever you have a question or a comment of any kind. So we're going to start with introductions. So I'll have each of the panel members say a little bit about yourselves, your background, your career path, your research interests, and you know, something that you find satisfying about your career. So, Paul?
Okay. I'm Paul Jessup. I'm the Dean of Science at Wilfrid Laurier University, but I started my career as a physics student at U of W quite a few years ago. And I could think I knew leaving high school that I wanted to study physics. And it was a little different in those days because we didn't really worry about getting a job, where I think students now worry a great deal. Although I took physics because I liked it first and foremost, but being in the sciences, you had a feeling that you're going to pick up some useful skills that would mean you didn't have to worry about getting a job. So we enjoyed it. The class I was in, I think there were about 40 graduates, and if I recall correctly, two of them were female. And so that you just sort of, we didn't question that. At least the men in the field didn't question it. That was just the way it was. It was like going into the army. Then I had a key influence for me was I had a good summer job at the National Research Council, and being at U of W, because it was co-op, we finished earlier than the other universities. So of the handful of students in that section with summer jobs, I was the first one to arrive, and I got my choice of the labs to work in, and the one had flashing lights and lasers, and that's the one I chose, and that summer sort of cemented my interest in lasers and optics. And then I had the good fortune to get admitted to Harvard, and I did my PhD there in atomic physics, and it ended up being laser spectroscopy. And I graduated at a time when there weren't a whole lot of jobs. When I was a student, both as an undergrad and as a graduate student, I really didn't aspire, and very few people did in my class, to an academic career. I figured I'd end up in industry. But I graduated at a time when there weren't that many jobs in industry, and so I went back to where I had been a summer student at the National Research Council, and that was enjoyable, very esoteric laser spectroscopy physics. I enjoyed the work, but I figured that was not a good place for a long-term career, because everybody at NRC was depressed about the future of the institution, and I felt a need to get more applied. And I tried to get a job in industry and couldn't, and so I took a research associate position at McMaster University to work with a particular group and hone my skills in semiconductor devices, which weren't very good at that time. So I didn't start as a professor, but within 6 months of arriving at McMaster, I applied to become one and was successful, and had a long career at McMaster in engineering physics. So I know John very well, because he was in the Department of Physics in the Faculty of Science, and I was in the Department of Engineering Physics in the Faculty of Engineering. And engineering, if you think science is bad, engineering is particularly bad for the ratio of female to male students. In my own department, which is one of the smaller ones, there were no female faculty members. And the fraction of female students was probably around 20% or so, which would be typical for a physics department. And in all the years I was there, which was 29 years, it didn't change that much over the years. And shortly after I left, they hired two female faculty members, so it may mean that I was part of the problem. But I came here. Now, while I was at McMaster, I had a few administrative positions. I was Associate Dean of Graduate Studies twice and chair of the department. And so my career was kind of split between administration and science and teaching. And you're not supposed to admit it if you're a good scientist, but I actually enjoyed the administration. And one of Shohini's questions was, what have you found rewarding in your career? And well, I certainly found the physics and the science rewarding. But personally, I found it rewarding to be useful. And I felt more useful on a day-to-day basis in administration sometimes than I did in research. Although the useful part of the research, the most rewarding part, I think, for me, was the interaction with the graduate students. So now I'm here. I've been here 2.5 years as the Dean of Science at Wilfrid Laurier, and I'm enjoying that a great deal. So.
Rachel?
My name is Rachel Ivey. I'm not a physicist. I'm a sociologist. I've been working at the American Institute of Physics for 15 years, where I collect survey data about the education and employment of physicists. And I also collect data on the status of women and minorities in physics, mostly in the US. I started working in this type of job after I got my PhD. Well, first of all, I wrote my dissertation on women in the military during World War II, which is obviously another very small group of women within a male organization. And after I got my PhD, I started teaching. But my husband and I wanted to work in the same place. He's also an academic, although he's a mathematician. And so we ended up working at small places where I was the only sociologist, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I decided that I wanted to leave academics and get what for a sociologist is an applied job. Sociologists have a lot of skills around research methodology in the social sciences, meaning we can collect data on what people do and what people think. So I took some of my research skills and started looking for a job outside of academics, and I got this job at the American Institute of Physics, where I collect a lot of survey data. I collect, you know, numbers and then analyze them with statistics. We also do some what we would call qualitative data, where we collect people's answers, sort of like Carla talked about, and then analyze those. So for the last, a few years or so, I've been talking about women in physics and bringing sort of a sociological perspective to the study of women in physics.
Okay, so I'm John Berlinski. I work here at the Perimeter Institute. My job is called Academic Program Director, which means that my office deals with mainly graduate students at the master's and PhD level, some undergraduate students who come in the summer, and a little bit with the postdocs. I've had a long career in physics. It's getting close to 50 years, so I won't take you through it all. I thought that I'd just focus on the parts of my career that are directly relevant to the subject of this workshop. But just to start with, I was raised and educated in the United States. I got my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, and I moved to Canada in the early 70s as a postdoc at the University of British Columbia. And eventually, later on in the 70s, I joined the faculty at UBC. In 1983, I was married to Catherine Cowan, who's another physicist. Currently, she's a Canada Research Chair in Theory of Quantum Materials at nearby McMaster University. And for a few years before and a couple of years after, we had a long-distance commuting relationship. But eventually, in 1985, when we had this little baby girl, we decided that we should try to live in the same city. We went on to the job market together, babe in arms, and we had quite a few experiences, some good, many bad. We got to the point where we rated universities and how well they dealt with the fact that the two of us and our baby were interviewing there together. I have to say that McMaster really came out on top. So we went to McMaster. We had two nice jobs. And later on, around 2000, I became one of those department chairs that we've been talking about. It was the time when it was possible to hire faculty. And the first two faculty that we hired were women. And I mention that this because we made use of two programs to hire these two particular women faculty. One was what was called the Women's Faculty Award, or eventually University Faculty Award, program of NSERC, which was specifically targeted to hiring women faculty. and it was an extremely useful program for the universities, which figured out how to make good use of it, not everywhere. Another woman faculty member was hired through the Canada Research Chairs program. So McMaster in science, level one is over 60% women, most of them heading towards the life sciences. Many outstanding students. And we developed a strategy for recruiting women into physics, which was, we called our A-plus program. Most of the students took physics in level one, and we targeted the ones who got an A-plus in a first-year physics course, and we showered them with recognition and benefits. And as a result, actually, perhaps not surprisingly, we ended up with a lot of women physics undergraduate students. I think it's a situation which persists until today. For whatever reason, that seems to have worked. I came to Perimeter in 2009, and my main task was to start up what's called Perimeter Scholars International, which is a one-year international master's program in theoretical physics. We recruit students, about between 30 and 40 students from all over the world. Typically, we have between 15 and 20 countries represented. And we also, I should say one of the many purposes of this school is to change the culture of theoretical physics, as I think Neil Turok alluded to that idea. And we do that through having a very diverse enrollment, which includes many women students. We specifically invite applications from women. About 1/6 of the applications that we receive this year 340 applications for 30 slots. About 1/6 of those are women, and we target about 1/3 of our class to be women. And this works actually extremely well. I can only speculate that the women students do a better job of self-selection, are quite realistic about whether to apply or not, so we have no trouble finding outstanding women students. So as a result of this, the culture of PSI is actually really different from your typical physics graduate class. And it's, I guess now we're just starting to learn about what those differences are. And I think I won't go on any further in that. Thanks.
Okay, so wealth of experience here, and we don't often get to, you know, ask panelists like these about questions of gender, typically. So this is our chance. So let's set the stage. In your experiences as administrators, physicists, researchers, if you had to rate on a scale of 1 to 10, what the current environment for women in physics is today, where 1 is bad and 10 is good, where do you think we stand now, and where can we go? Who wants to go first?
I will, or you can.
No, go ahead.
I mean, I know this is gonna sound wishy-washy, but I don't really think you can give one score overall. In some places it's terrible, in some places it's really pretty good, and even in, like Carla said, there's places where there's different cultures depending on your status. Is there, like, are you a woman or an underrepresented minority or something like that? That culture can be very different than it can be for the majority group. So I think you have to look carefully at the institutional practices and policies before you go work at a place to see if it's some place where there might be a congenial climate for you.
So, and I know you've done some studies on what this kind of climate is. Have you seen any kinds of patterns that are positive or negative?
Someone mentioned earlier the American Physical Society's site visits. where the APS will go to departments that request a site visit and have the outside committee will come and review the climate for women. And as part of that, we do a survey of usually the graduate students there to see what the climate is. And there's just really a wide variety. There's been places where I couldn't believe what the people were writing because it was so terrible. I mean, some of the stuff they were talking about that went on is illegal in the US. And then there's other places where things are a little bit better for the graduate students. And I think a lot of that does depend on the leadership of the department chair and whether or not they're willing to take a stand and say, we won't tolerate certain kinds of behavior. So, yeah, that's what I've seen in the studies. It's just a variety of experiences.
Paul, are you going to risk a number, a score?
Number? No, I won't. I refuse. You know, you're asking good or bad now.
Oh, you asked for a number,
yeah.
Right? Sorry.
if the target that defines good is roughly equal representation, then it would get a very low score. But what the environment is for an individual woman in physics, I hesitate to quite answer that beside you. I think John made a good point about the women students having, they're a different group. My experience in engineering, and I think the same would be true in physics, was that there seemed to be very few struggling female students in engineering, and if you looked at the ones who were struggling, that were failing out, they tended to be the males, because I think the students who come into engineering and probably physics, if they're female, they really, really want to. They've overcome that obstacle. So in the places I've been, I would say the environment for the individual is neutral. You know, it's not that different in terms of the opportunities and the social environment. Now, there are probably a lot of things I'm just oblivious to, but the systemic things I haven't seen in the institutions I've been.
John?
So I'll just talk about Perimeter. I mean, or maybe I should say, I mean, theoretical physics is a bit of a harsh, cold environment for many people, but I think for women in particular. I mean, there's a real pecking order, and people are only interested in talking to people who they think, who are either at their level or perhaps if they can learn something from, and they don't go out of their way to be social. So there are some real serious issues here that we're confronting. And I think we've had experiences which are not good with, say, senior women scientists. I'll just mention, because I think she wouldn't mind if I mentioned, my wife coming here once to give a colloquium, and she got an office. And then she was wondering when people were going to come along to take her for lunch, and nothing happened, so she went down to the old bistro and looked around and didn't see anyone she knew. So she went back, and then later she came back. And eventually she just decided to sit down with this group of string theorists, mainly graduate students and postdocs, I think it was, and just start talking. So it's, how should I say it? There's lots of barriers to be overcome. I mean, if we had a lot of women theoretical physicists here, I think that there's no question that it would be a different place. So theoretical physics is tough. I think engineering is equally tough for different reasons. Not that great for women.
So let's talk about hiring, which, you know, is when most women and men start out. What can you describe from your own institutions and whatever you may have studied on this, what are the criteria that are currently being used for hiring? I know some institutions have policies around, you know, equity in hiring. How do those help? or are there hidden biases in hiring? Is it fair across genders? What do you think?
At Laurier, the hiring practices are formalized in the collective agreement, which isn't the case at U of W or at McMaster to the same extent. And so there are provisions in the collective agreement that are intended to ensure fairness and equity, so the hiring committees must have at least one tenured female. If the department's small and doesn't have a tenured female, you have to import one. And so there are structural things like that that can be written in. But they have limited effect, I think, because it's sort of a principle, if all else is equal, you will hire the female or the minority person. But all else is seldom equal. And so you have to, then comes down to the individuals on the hiring committee and how firmly committed they are to this. I know in McMaster, the dean, who was the dean when I left, had more flexibility than a dean at Laurier would, because it wasn't as dictated by the collective agreement. And there was an informal affirmative action, and I think that helped. But it's unless you're going to introduce quotas, which I don't think anybody really wants that rigid an approach, then you're back to people's biases, and the pool of applicants is the main thing. You talk about the leaky pipeline. I think that's the biggest effect of all. So we should do all these things in terms of structure, but there's no miracle cure.
Can I just interject there, in terms of having looked at some of the advanced programs and probably talking about some of their materials? One of the things around hiring that's very obvious from their materials is the idea that you should be giving constructive feedback in the hiring process all the way along. And so I mentioned on the faculty association committee, the performance subcommittee, where we're trying to look at some of these issues. So the idea that, there are certain things that will increase your pool of applicants, increase the diversity in that pool, the way you write the ad, the writing of the ad, all the way along the hiring process. If you look at these procedures, there are ways of improving the hiring process, improving the diversity of the pool, and potentially whether or not you finally hire a female or not, improving the excellence of the person that you hire. And so I would encourage maybe you to look at those, publications and the things that can be done in terms of process of hiring. So this wouldn't change in the case of Waterman necessarily the policy 76 that encourages best practices in hiring. It would be changing the implementation of those best practices and giving very specific advice on the best
I wanted to say thank you for that. I wanted to say more about the advanced program in the States. Which the government has funded, I've lost count, many different institutions to actively, they give them a pile of money, which like Carla said, really increases awareness among the upper administration of the problem, which is a big help. And one of the things that the institutions do though, the government doesn't dictate how the funds should be spent, but most of them try to implement some sort of training of faculty members, especially around how to hire a new faculty member. And I think maybe on a micro level that's been very effective. One of the things that's come out of the advanced program at the University of Michigan is a lot of discussion of what's called unconscious bias. And I think a lot of physical scientists don't know about these things, but when you're raised in any type of culture, you learn to categorize your world, to sort your world into different categories. And one of the most important categories in our culture and in most cultures across the world is gender. I mean, think how important it is to know someone's sex. You have to know it even before they're born, right? And so immediately we began to sort people into male or female and attribute characteristics to them based solely on that status as either male or female. And so that continues all the way up to unconsciously made decisions both on the part of men and women about who would be best for the job. And there's actually training you can do to become aware of these biases and to try to overcome them. So I know different places have enacted workshops where they have to role play a faculty hiring meeting, and then the people in the audience point out things that might be evidence of a bias, for example, coming out of a faculty member's mouth. There's funny adaptations like gender bias bingo, where you can get a bingo card. It's like, I don't know, some group in the States made it, and every time you hear something coming out of a faculty member's mouth at a hiring meeting, you know, you can exit out until you can yell, actually you're supposed to yell bullshit, sorry. if y'all can't tell from my accent, I'm from the South, and we're not supposed to say words like that. But anyway, trying to overcome that gender stereotype that women aren't supposed to talk like that. You know, one of the things are like, you know, you might have a square on your bingo card that says, if we don't hire him, Stanford will, okay? And, you know, another square might say something like, I don't see how she's going to get enough research done if she's a new mother, or something like that. You know, something that people might actually say they shouldn't say, but if you get enough squares covered there, it's a kind of a way to make it through faculty meetings if your institution hasn't implemented some of these changes. But I do think the advanced program is a way that they've really tried to look at the faculty hiring decision, and there's a lot of best practices on people's websites that they've learned from the advanced program. They've brought in social scientists and other people who try to help faculty members uncover their unconscious bias and make themselves more aware of how to have an open search process, how to actively, intentionally recruit women to apply rather than just throwing up their hands and going, I don't know any women. I'm like, of course you don't know any women, but you can go look for some. So that's what I have to say about hiring.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually, I think, the most important thing. I think proactive recruiting, if one is going to, you know, hire more women physicists, actually, it's in fact, any of the underrepresented groups, it's basically the same thing. If you aren't constantly looking at potential candidates, in this case, say, women candidates, who you think would really do well in your department, and instead you're just waiting until hiring time, putting up ads, and taking applications, then I think you're missing out on your best bets. I think, in a sense, all department chairs, all hiring committees should be on the lookout all the time for the candidates that they'd like to recruit.
Let's take some questions right way back there, yeah.
One of the things that I think that has come out in the discussions, and particularly from the last talk, that a lot of this is very department dependent. Depending on the culture in the department, depending on who's the chair, you can get very different results for a type of climate that's in a department for women or for people of minorities. And so it seems like it's sort of a very slow and lumbering process where individual departments, if they get lucky to get a good chair, can have a real climate change in their department that improves things. Is there maybe a better way, like you mentioned the government having some programs to, you know, give money to departments that make changes, but is there ways to sort of think about this instead of sort of a slow way where individual departments either get lucky or not to have a chair that has vision? Is there something more that can be done that's a little bit more systematic that can make these changes rather than just sort of leaving it up almost to chance in a way for individual departments to get lucky with individuals that have visions to see this changing? I don't know if there's ideas or if you've seen things that have worked.
I can talk about some of the efforts in the States, but I don't know if these guys want to go first.
No, go ahead.
Okay. In the States, we have a law called Title IX, which says that educational resources must be distributed. There must be no sex bias or, you know, inequality in educational resources. And historically, that has been applied to our sports programs, where, for example, you know, there have to be teams available open to women. Whereas, you know, for example, I don't know if y'all know this, 50 years ago, there might not be any women's teams. If there were even women students, there might not be any women teams. There has been a movement in the States to apply Title IX to science, so that if you get government funding, you have to document that the resources have been applied equally to men and women, that, for example, there might be no differences in lab space between male researchers and female researchers. I haven't heard about those efforts in a while, but I thought you might want to know that they've gone on and that there is that law in the states. One problem in the states is that our government, the Supreme Court in 1978, I think, declared things like quotas were unconstitutional or illegal. So people have tried to set up programs that didn't depend on specific numbers. And time and again, those have been struck down so that, you know, now we can't have, for affirmative action, for example, designed at underrepresented minorities. It has to be, you know, applied equally to whites and blacks. And so now they've gone to, you know, affirmative action that's class-based, economic-based, which, of course, helps many underrepresented minorities, but not all. So I think one of the things you hear me talking about is my experience as an American, where that's how our government is basically handled it, saying, well, you know, we're not going to mandate anything. You know, good luck to you, basically, is what they're saying. And so I wish I had better news for you. Maybe the Title IX people will be able to get something going, because it was very effective in sports in the states.
Can I just inject here? Because actually, when I was making a few notes this morning, I actually went on to the web and copied down the section from the Canada Charter of Rights and Freedoms about affirmative action. And
no, see, that's not
it's unlike the United States. It is explicitly specified in our Charter of Rights.
Yeah.
There's equality, but nevertheless, to redress imbalances and historic wrongs, we are able to have affirmative action, which is why NSERC was able to create a program that targeted women hiring back in the 90s and early 2000s.
Our National Science Foundation recently said that postdocs are going to be able to take parental leave, which parental leave in the states is kind of the worst in the industrialized world, but at least the National Science Foundation said that postdocs can take it. So at least that's a government agency doing something. Now notice it can't be sex specific, but you know, of course it will help women, the fact that postdocs can now on National Science Foundation take maternity leave in the case of women.
Paul, do you want to jump?
Just back to your original question, I think one thing that we can do at the universities is to encourage department chairs, deans, and the more senior positions to be filled by women, and that there is the flexibility to do that. So I think for somebody like a dean who's nudging and trying to talk people into being chairs, that's a useful and important thing to do. And if the balance of men and women in among the chairs and the deans becomes healthier, I think that will filter down to the department levels.
Now, in the states, a private foundation can do what it wants. So, you know, if anybody here becomes incredibly wealthy, you could set up a private foundation that only helps women or whoever you want to help.
So the only other comment I'd make on this question is that the situation which was described sort of looks at a subcritical state that we're in now, where any improvements are sort of upward fluctuations, which then quickly can fluctuate back. But of course, the goal is to change the culture, to get sort of irreversibly change the culture so that then these gender issues will be dealt with in a totally different way. I'm sure there will be new problems that will arise in that different culture, but it won't necessarily just be always backsliding.
Melanie?
Yeah, can I comment on the maternity and parental leave issue? Actually, in Canada, the NSERC has been funding a lot of postdoctoral scholarships, actually have now maternity and parental leave policies for graduate students. And some of that actually came out of the University of Waterloo, because the University of Waterloo had those policies for their graduate students before the agencies did, and helped put some pressure on the agencies, as one of the members of the committee,
And to follow up on what you said, Melanie, actually the maternity and parental leaves in that program, I believe, are a little bit less than what you get from EI, employment insurance, and the other postdocs who are not on national scholarships or grants and are just paid through their supervisors' grants, they do pay employment insurance, but they are not entitled to maternity or parental leave. So that's a whole different ball, yeah. Was there a question there? Oops, I can't see.
Yeah. I guess I'm not like continuing along this particular line, but I was kind of want to respond to something that John said about this pecking order in physics. So, you know, as a man, like, we're not looking at this large scale, but as a student in this program, like for example in PSI program or in some other physics program, you know, how would you make the woman feel comfortable? Like, I don't think I'm a typical example, but let's say point out two ways in which I might not feel comfortable if I'm not, like, with respect to this pecking order. First of all, so if the you know, the 10 students and 9 of them are men and everyone wants to talk to the women, they don't treat you like you're in this order. Like, I would like to be ranked in that order, number one. So I don't want them to give me special treatment. That's just personal. And secondly, I will feel uncomfortable if they start assuming that you're stupid because you're a woman. So there's, you know, another way of being out of the order. So basically these two issues, how do you balance them, you know, and as a woman in your program, do they feel that they're either treated too well because they're women or that they are biased against because they're a woman, you know?
Can I, yeah, so I've had delegations come to my office and say that this was a concern, that the women really got the free ride or easy access to our program. And I guess, so what I've tried to convince people of in that situation is that they were extremely well qualified. The application pool that we have is not statistical in any way. What motivates students to apply or not to apply to PSI is personal, but it has a big gender component. This year in particular, I can tell you we've had absolutely no trouble finding outstanding women candidates, many times at the top of our lists. And so the invitation of women students to apply to our program is simply to get it to happen, okay? And we then apply a standard that we think is appropriate, which is a very, very high standard. And they go off and do well, so.
So I guess my question was not at the decision level or policy level. And just one quick question, is the delegate who came to you a man, a woman? Like,
I'm sorry, I can't.
The people who...
The delegates who came to you, were they men or
women? They were women.
They were women saying that.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not students, but they're...
They were students.
They were students saying
they
that.
They were our students, PSI students.
Yeah. See, yeah. I think this plays into, like, this, you know, it's easy for women to feel that they're taking advantage of the system. I mean, I'm not saying that... it's internal psychology that impacts their performance. That's what I'm getting at.
But it's not totally internal, too. You hear it. People tell you that.
Yeah, people like to say that the woman gets more help. The men
Yeah, but I mean, they say they would like to get more help. But then on the other hand, as we know, there's these huge barriers. So how does that fit?
I mean, I think sort of in the culture, the man always sees, I mean, everyone, like not just men, they see women as the gender that needs help, right? And they're conditioned to think that, like, so if women get asked a question and they receive help, they say they receive help because they're women. And if a man kind of asks questions, they don't just, it's not considered on the same basis. And I think this is one of the psychological issues that women have to deal with being in the stream of physics. They constantly have to fight against the preconception that they, anytime they don't know something or they are getting something from some people, they're getting help. And maybe because, you know, everything becomes help when man gets them, they're just getting what they need from the system. Somehow there's a different notion.
Can I just say something? I mean, yeah. So it's, you know, there are real gender differences. Okay, in between our men and women students, and people worry about different things, and probably a lot of the men students, not all of them, worry a lot less. Okay, but in the end, if you would like to eventually get to a different state, then there would be more balance between the genders, and people would adjust more to that situation. But I mean, I think I recognize everything that you're saying, and these are all really real problems. And hopefully, you know, one would like to think, I mean, they're long-standing traditional problems. I would like to think that they're transitional problems.
Yeah, I don't know how it could be maybe taught, like educating the whole population to think differently, to that women feel that they're less undeserving or something.
This is not the question, but I think the world years ago was defined by male. The culture was like that. It wasn't a grand male conspiracy, right? But guys work, women stay at home, took care of the kids. I see the problem of having more women. I think the issue is not the ideal worker, but the ideal workplace. And that ideal workplace will not emerge until more women are in position of power, being chairs, being physicists, being whatever. So I don't, I mean, the solution sounds difficult because you need more women, but I am absolutely convinced in every single area, until we have more women, things are not going to change much, despite the fact that we have guys, kind as you, willing to, no, in the way that you said, I can realize that you are conscious of the problem of women, and you would love to have a better environment. But I think we need more women in positions.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's the central thing.
I think that I agree with you, but I think men also have to be aware of this problem. Everybody needs to play gender bias bingo, I mean, even if you don't have a card, because when you see something like you described where people are assuming that you need help, right, you need to say that's bullshit, okay? I mean, that's part of a gender bias that we may not need in our society anymore. And so I think that men and women have to be aware of these issues or nothing will ever change. Yeah. Right. So I encourage you, if you see something that is wrong or a stereotype, I think you should call it out. So.
Role model.
I won't argue with that, but I just want to reinforce the value, I think, of having women in senior positions. And it's subtle because men, you know, every once in a while can be insensitive or not notice things, and my female colleagues will point things out that just didn't occur to me at this level. And I think the more of that, the better. And another, what we were talking at the break, we're talking about university environments. And so I grew up in a university environment where it was all men, and then went and worked in graduate studies. And I was working, it was like a business office. And all of a sudden I was working with mostly women. They weren't faculty members, most of them, but I was overwhelmed by the number of women. And that was an interesting educational experience. And one thing I've become sensitive to, now that I'm dean, is sort of the condescension of faculty members towards staff members, which is very unhealthy. And that, on the surface of it, isn't gender-related, but the staff members tend often to be more female, and the faculty the other way around. So it becomes a very complicated issue. But I think the more you get males and females working together as equals, then they're not quite so insensitive, and it becomes a much healthier environment.
It's not just number, it's position as well. It's
position. If you're reporting to a woman for a man, that's not what you are used to, perhaps, in an academic environment. But that's a very healthy arrangement. Yeah.
Right there. Go ahead. Yes.
It is, because you're going against a gender stereotype to do that, but go ahead.
I'm a female grad student, and in the first couple of years when people said things, I would just be like, hey, what's up, like, I have kind of a body note, so I pointed out, and I've got a kind of reputation for that, like, people say, oh, be careful what you say around her, because she's a feminist, and so now I don't really say, point these things out anymore, it's just like, well, now I know you're an asshole, and I'm not going to do
Yeah, I'm sorry that's happened to you. It looks like Carla has a comment. Did you have a comment about that?
Interject a minute. Can you give me time to get around with the microphone before you start the comments? Because otherwise it's not being on the recording and maybe people at the back can't hear. So there's someone here waiting for a comment for a while.
I just wanted to say that, you know, we have examples of women in power. I mean, not just in universities, but outside as leaders. We have had presidents, prime ministers in many countries which are very patriarchal, and these having women in these leadership positions hasn't changed. So I don't think having women in power is going to change, as long as women must play the male game in power, right? So I think that what needs to change, our cultural values have to change. I don't think that just having women in power is going to change much. So something else has to go on, you know, in terms of values. And women should also be targeted, and as well as men, in order to change attitudes. Because as long as women themselves believe that, you know, in male dominance and so on, nothing is going to change. Or as long as women believe that they have to play the male game in positions of power, then nothing is going to change. So I think there are different levels of intervention, not just having women in positions of power.
Carla, do you want to say something, or? Okay, after that, yeah.
So I had a question. As people in sort of positions of power, I'm wondering, so you're in a position where you're the most able to make these types of changes. So I'm wondering if you could implement one thing that you think is the most innovative or the most useful into these systems, what would it be to do something positive?
Do you want to go first, John?
Well, I mean, you mean for gender equity and having a better culture? I mean, yeah, I think it's already been said that if you simply had more women in these, so then you need to set up your system to achieve that. I mean, so, you know, in my case, you know, it might require some resources, it might require going, well, actually we're in a pretty good position because we're a master's program, but we feed the PhD program. So the PhD program is actually improving in its gender balance. So then where do you go next? Postdocs? Well, actually at Perimeter, there's been a little bit of top down to encourage hiring more women postdocs, and I must say it's working spectacularly well. I mean, we've hired some for next year, some outstanding candidates, but that little bit of top down makes a big difference. So but then the payoff is going to be in faculty hirings, and there basically we have a small faculty, but we also a source for you know, we provide faculty candidates to a lot of places. So really, I think in our little organization here, it's simply, you know, having the people who control the resources give us free rein, and it's okay at the moment. It's we're getting there.
I would get rid of the cultural expectation or this bias that women can't do science. That's what I would get rid of. Like, if I could go poof and change something, that's what I get rid of. Because I think a lot of the problems that we're talking about come from our culture and the way we sort people into expectations based on their sex. And so, you know, graduate students run up against things where they can't say something because, you know, they're being, you know, squashed when they try to bring attention to these issues. And then women don't want to go into science because they've been taught all along that it's really not for women. I mean, it's okay to take it in high school so you can get into college, but do it? No, I don't think so. And I think that's the expectation that we need to get rid of.
Which I think just like the Women in Science Center that's been started at Laurier serves many functions, but one is to address this and to get over the stereotype that women don't do science. You've got to start at a very young age, and so outreach to the grade schools even more so than the high schools. The trouble is there's so many of them that they're spread pretty thin. But another benefit is just having the conversation within the organization. So the fact that there is this center, it raises the level of awareness, and you know, it perhaps helps to show the institution is a little friendlier, at least conscious of the problem. It's the first step towards being friendlier.
Carla.
So if I can just speak up for a minute, in particular in response to what you had to say about being a graduate student and having to call gender bias when you saw it, and how horrible that particular situation is, and then being silenced and then in response. And I think that's one place where we need to think about who are the bystanders and that make up our culture, and that there is an obligation for bystanders to speak up. And there are ways to do that better or worse. And one place to look is that MIT has a website, if you just Google bystander training. And part of bystander training, it's a beautiful website that is really helpful in terms of giving you lines or ways of thinking, ways of deciding when it's useful to step in or not step in, and to realize that in your silence, it often seems that you're being complicit with the statements that are being made. And so there are places there for our fellows, for our colleagues, for people who are lower than us in the hierarchy, who are higher than us in the hierarchy, to step in. The other thing that's so important in that case is male allies, and the role, especially that the people who are leaders in our institutions have in setting standards for the cultures of our institutions, and realizing that oftentimes small events like that don't get spoken about because it's just an off-the-cuff comment, and we don't realize that those off-the-cuff comments add up to make a climate or a culture, and that Virginia Valiant has a beautiful line where she says that mountains are made up of molehills, and so in that perspective, I think it's very important for our leaders to set zero tolerance for that sort of behavior.
There's also a nice website called microaggressions.com where you can post any kind of little aggressive, I mean, not little, any kind of aggressive statement or biased statement that's said to you. There's things about sexual orientation, things about your race. So, I mean, if you don't feel safe saying it out loud, you can post it, you know, and I guess that might help. But see, as a grad student, you're in kind of a relatively less powerful position. You might someday find yourself in a more powerful position. And I'll, you know, use a little example for myself. I have two sons, and they both could identify a gender stereotype by the time they were 8. And I still call my 18-year-old out on it, okay? When he makes his girlfriend call me to say what the plans are for dinner, I'm like, uh-uh. You're making her do what sociologists call emotional labor. So, I mean, those are just two little boys, right? But, I mean, at least maybe I could do something, right, by at least calling it out for them. And I am in a position of relative power over them still, even the 18-year-old, because he wants money.
You think so.
You think.
Yeah.
I guess so here is there's a gap between what happens in society, like in relationships, for example, and what happens at workplace. So, and this is a gap that, you know, sometimes as a woman, you really get stranded in between. Let's say if you want somebody to take you seriously at work, you need to show just a little bit of aggression, right, compared to how you're, you know, how they would like to see their girlfriends behaving. You know, there's this thing, I mean, that, or just, you know, I don't know what's natural. There are people studying the psychology between men and women, what's natural and what's not. I mean, I don't know where's the most comfortable place. Are women just generally more caring and less aggressive just as a, you know, how they're made, like biologically? Or what are they made to do, right? And should I think both sides need to change. Like you're saying, this dinner plan thing that's in the relationship setting, should the men kind of give more lead to the woman? Like, I mean, or and similarly in a workplace, like John was saying, that we should maybe make the whole place softer, I mean, be more considerate. And so, like, I think both sides need to kind of meet together. I mean, because the personal life is part of it too, right? You know, you're like, you cannot, women right now often are under the pressure to be different people at work and at home.
I think this really talks about the cultural expectations that are placed on women. There was actually a study done not too long ago that showed if women were too aggressive at work and negotiating for salaries, they were seen in a negative light because they were violating traditional gender standards. So I think it is a really tough place to be, and that's why what we need to start talking about is changing the culture. And that's why, you know, if you can, you know, talk to people about these things, if possible. I will say about what are people supposed to do, sociologists take the viewpoint that there's really very little in terms of biological, like chromosomal things that express themselves in personality. That's all created by culture. I realize that's an extreme view that some people wouldn't agree with, but think about how often how soon our society starts categorizing people into male and female. It's even before birth, like I mentioned earlier. There were studies done a long time ago in the 1970s that showed in the hospital, mothers and fathers treating their boy babies more roughly and more aggressively than their girl babies. So it starts like as newborns. So, I mean, we could do things differently.
Yeah, I think, for example, this climate that's going on at workplace, I think can have an impact on the personal life of successful women. Because, for example, because if they take work really seriously, they will take the same attitude into their relationships. And like just saying, and where the man will be doing all the agenda booking and stuff. And, you know, like it's just something they wouldn't let go because they really take work seriously. And I think, you know, just being stranded, it's kind of a difficult position to be in. And I think men should also think about how they would like their partner at home to behave, and kind of bridge the gap between their expectation of the how they would like the woman they have at home and with what the kind of woman they have at workplace. Can they use the same attitude? Like, how do they bridge the gap for make their own personal decisions, and they treat them kind of equally, I mean, with the same expectations?
Sometimes men really see the light when they have a daughter, right? So. And all of a sudden she can't, like Emmy Noether's father, right? She couldn't take classes at the university, but he got her in.
So on that note, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and making physics work, that's still an open question, and I hope you'll keep talking about. Thanks to our panel and all the great questions.